Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Today, on a special archive edition of The Mark Steiner Show, we discuss The Simpsons. Their importance, influence, and creativity has been debated since they first hit the airwaves over 20 years ago. But few could have predicted or seen that The Simpsons would also become part of a discussion about the spiritual essence of our nation, of the American people. Some churches use The Simpsons as part of their religious discussions in classes and seminars. Joining us is religion writer Mark Pinsky, author of The Gospel According to The Simpsons, The Spiritual Life of the World's Most Animated Family. We're also joined by Pastor Corinne Baker of the Light Street Presbyterian Church, who has held discussions in her church about The Simpsons. And Pastor Matthew Furman of Salem Lutheran Church grew up watching The Simpsons and keeps a figure of Reverend Lovejoy in his office. Then later in the hour, we'll have a conversation with Harry Shearer, the voice of some of the characters on the show. I really was kind of shocked when Aaron and others kind of brought this to my attention and said, this is a great book. This is an incredibly interesting subject. Listeners are going to love it. You got to talk about the spiritual life and the gospel according to The Simpsons. And my first reaction is, what are you talking about? All I remember about The Simpsons is that you start off with The Simpsons as this kind of something that I think banal kind of group on TV or a satirical cartoon or something that kind of offends adults that children love to use to offend their parents with. But now we're taking all of that in a much more serious way. And let me just start with the man who wrote the book, Mark Pinsky, because from looking here, you don't look like a man who grew up with The Simpsons, or you did with your family, didn't you?
No, I was not a fan. I hadn't. It was sort of on the edge of my radar screen until about 2 years ago when my children, then 8 and 11, we don't allow TV watching during the school year. I'm kind of a...
During the whole school year?
During school nights.
School nights. School nights.
Just a kind of a hardliner on that side, particularly for an old lefty like myself. But during the summer, we take it on a case-by-case basis, and they said they wanted to watch The Simpsons. And all I knew about the show was its sort of cheeky reputation, and not wanting to be the authoritarian dad, I said, okay, here's the deal. We'll watch together. And if it's okay, we'll keep watching. If it's not okay, we'll stop. I was mostly concerned about less with authority than sexuality issues. And so my kids are very bright, blah, blah, blah. So we began watching. The first thing I noticed was that there wasn't anything I found offensive for my children to watch. But then the second thing I noticed as a religion writer was how frequent and how favorable were the mentions of God, faith, and spirituality. So naturally, being a reporter, I grabbed my reporter's notepad and began taking notes. And we were watching like 11 episodes a week, two reruns a night and the newer ones on Sunday nights. And I thought I might be getting a skewed sample of just the rotation of the episodes. Mm-hmm. So then the first weekend, I went out and I bought a guidebook to The Simpsons and went through episode by episode and found out, no, this is a theme. These are themes. And it was so counterintuitive that I wrote about it.
Let me turn to the two pastors in the room, and Corinne Baker first. I mean, so you, and what led you to The Simpsons and led you to creating a discussion group within your church?
What led me to The Simpsons was my two sons, Dan and Dave, and they, the first couple of years, come on, Mom, sit down, watch it with us. And, oh, come on, I've got better things to do. You haven't watched it. So I sat down, and I've been addicted ever since.
and we'll come to the discussion groups in a second. Matthew Furman, I mean, you grew up with The Simpsons. Is this what led you to the seminary?
Oh, my. Yeah, I grew up with The Simpsons, had, I would say, progressive, permissive parents who, I guess, since its beginning, let me watch the show even though I was a young teen. As The Simpsons has grown and evolved, and I think the sophistication of the humor has grown and evolved, I think for people of my generation, people in their late 20s, early 30s, there's been an appreciation for the truth that the episodes can convey and really the strong social commentary on a number of institutions that The Simpsons play out. As Mark said, I would say favorably and I don't think unjustly. So it's been a resource, I think, and a common bond for a number of young folks and increasingly people throughout the culture as they learn that it's more than simply slapstick and lowbrow humor. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of that, and there's plenty of that in seminary, so maybe that's the connection. but that there is a level that's there, and I think a lot of people have come to appreciate that.
No issue is a sacred cow.
That's right.
You treat every issue with some disdain and some admiration.
I think also what is consistent is that all institutions of modern life are satirized. Everybody takes their whacks. And so religion is an institution of modern life, so the organized church comes in for its share of satire. But God is not mocked. Sincere belief is not mocked. It seems so in the portrayal of Ned Flanders, the evangelical neighbor, mm-hmm. but not really, I think. I argue that they do portray him sometimes as being overzealous in his religious beliefs, being narrow-minded in his political beliefs. But if you look beneath that, he's always motivated by love, and he is not a hypocrite. If you look, I mean, the key, I think the primary undermining sin of American religion in the past 100 years has not been sex and has not been money. It's been hypocrisy. And Ned, whatever he is not a hypocrite, and he's always motivated by love. And evangelical Christians in my part of the country, in the Bible Belt, have increasingly come to recognize that. It's a positive portrayal.
Hmm. Now, what I just – is this a conscious effort by the people who write this program?
No. As a matter of fact, they were embarrassed when I first began to call them and interview them. At first, they were hesitant to say that it existed. And then I began citing chapter and verse. And finally, what emerged was a believable argument. And they said, we never thought this domestic comedy would go as far as it would go, would last for 13 seasons. The conceit is that nobody grows any older, so nobody really changes. And so after a certain number of years, they run out of ideas. If you go back to Father Knows Best, Leave It to Beaver, All in the Family, there are only a certain number of domestic situations that can be portrayed. Mom gets a job. Dad loses his job. Borrow the power tool from the neighbor and don't return it. What happened was that they hit on religion as an act of creative desperation. They had run out of ideas. And because in the early years of television, religion was off limits, it hadn't already been done to death. So these moral issues, the role of the church, the role of the minister, the role of prayer, saying grace at meals, reading the Bible, this was virgin territory. And it seemed to work. The first episode they really tried to make it work was a Homer and Lisa versus the Eighth Commandment about theft, about a victimless crime that really wasn't a victimless crime, stealing cable TV service. And the girl, classic case, it happens in real life. Lisa, the girl, learns thou shalt not steal in Sunday school and comes home and begins to apply it in the family and makes everybody uncomfortable. And the episode was so well received that the writer said, well, we did this good with this commandment. Let's see what else they got back there. And that's how it began.
Our church discussion, we used that particular episode of Lisa and the Eighth Commandment for discussion. And I think that one of the aspects that I have particularly enjoyed is that these characters portray all of us at some point. I identify with Homer when he does dumb stunts. Oh, gosh, why did I do that? And then at times, I'm a Marge who can be the loyal, supportive person.
The wife.
And then at times, I'm Lisa, who is on the right side, I think, of social justice. But then sometimes I'm Maggie because I'm tired and I'm just an onlooker. And then sometimes I'm like Bart. So it helps all of us, I think, see ourselves and not take ourselves too seriously. And because I think God loves a good laugh, and that's particularly shown in this episode.
Go ahead, man.
I was going to draw back to something that Mark had said about hypocrisy. And speaking for that same generation that I think is the key demographics for the show, I think in terms of an understanding and expression of faith, talking to young people, that there can oftentimes be a desire or a wish to have that in their life. But at some point along the way, organized religion, be it a pastor or a faction in a particular community, has led them to see it as an organization of hypocrisy, and that has turned them off. So I think the fact that the show can attack that and look at it openly is a very positive thing. And I think for faith leaders or people involved in church, it can be a healthy thing to look at and see that lifted up and say, you know, is that what we're doing? Is it the, you know, welcome to St. Anywhere's Church. Glad to have you here. Now you're sitting in my pew. So And it does that for policemen. It does that for education. It does that for the medical community. It's a very powerful show with a very powerful voice.
And yet they always come back to being that stable family that does have a strong faith, even though there's
hypocrisy. Yeah, they work through all of that
to
get to the same end.
Stable? I mean, some people would argue the Simpsons are dysfunctional.
Argue that it's always the argument, and to some degree it's true. But here's a family that always stays together.
That's right.
A nuclear family. And for all their failings, and in some cases their sins, they reinforce one another and they love one another. For all the dysfunction, which is at stage center, if you look at the broader context, they stay together and they love each other. And in many ways traditional. And also the family represents a spectrum of sort of types. You have Homer the dad who's this is an ostensibly Protestant family. That's the conceit of the show.
We know that because
they go to church. They go to a Protestant church every Sunday.
That would be a key,
right? And, but Homer the dad is really a borderline pagan.
Yes,
I mean his belief is entirely fear based. I mean he's afraid of God, and he could be a druid as much as he could be a Christian.
Like my mother.
Funny, she doesn't look Jewish.
She didn't. She looked Jewish.
And then you have Marge, who's the sort of suffering saint. She's the sort of the good Christian who always tries to keep things together, who does believe in blind faith to some degree. And you have the daughter, Lisa, who's really a skeptic in many ways, but a believing skeptic, who until recently at least was really sort of exemplar of mainline Christianity. And you have Bart, who some people would argue is the devil incarnate. But even when Bart gets in trouble, Bart knows where to go for help.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, it's funny, or as Homer says, it's funny because it's true. From all the religion writing I've done and all the polling data I've seen, the conduct of this family, saying grace, reading the Bible, going to church, praying out loud, this family more accurately reflects the life of people on the other side of the screen in America than any other show on commercial television.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. I think
you're
so.
Saying yes. Why do you say yes?
Because it appeals to that part of all of us that we know we really have inside. And that is available for, in religious terms, we might say, is available for salvation. And usually they find that with each other, reinforced with each other. And it's very well written in that Father Knows Best was never realistic for my generation. But The Simpsons, as my children say, my adult children say, that's me. That's me. I do those things, and yet I don't have to try to be somebody I'm not. I don't have to try to be better than I know I can be, unrealistic. I can attain that goal.
Matthew Furman grew up with The Simpsons and actually has an action figure of Reverend Lovejoy in his office. Is that true?
Yes, I do.
That's it.
Sorry for that to be my claim to fame, but
it's good enough.
It's Reverend Lovejoy is a wonderful and, I think, complex character. And one that I think that clergy should and can take a look at. And in fact, in one of my favorite episodes, it deals with clergy burnout, which is something that is very prevalent in across denominations. And one of my favorite scenes from that episode has Reverend Lovejoy and his wife on vacation, and they're at an outdoor cafe in Paris, and you see the Eiffel Tower behind them, and he's on the phone with one of his members dealing with very trivial problems. And it's about renewal. It's about focusing, something that we all need to do.
But this church, I'm going to go right to the phone to you, but the church that Lovejoy has is this kind of very straightforward Lutheran, perhaps Presbyterian church, you might think, and with a congregation that comes in because they think they have to come in, but they're not really deeply involved in the spiritual life of that institution.
No, in many ways, it resembles a typical mainline Protestant church.
Or synagogue or any other place, when you can think about
right.
it in a sense.
But there are some things to notice. And one of the things is that the pews are always full, which is not typical of mainline religion these days. You might also notice that they're both black people and white people worshiping together, also atypical.
Right.
and wealthy people and poor people, working class people and bosses. In that sense, it's atypical. And in other ways, it's atypical. And that is that for all the failings of Reverend Lovejoy, and there are legion, he's portrayed, as Matt says, as a fully formed person. He has a daughter who's kind of a demon seed. He has a wife who can be a shrew. He never has enough money. People fall asleep during his sermons. He knows his sermons are boring. Yet, here's a church after 13 years in which he's still the pastor.
Yes.
I mean, I've never written about or been a member of a congregation in my life that did not have a clergy party and an anti-clergy party. But in this church, they don't walk away. They don't conspire against him. They don't say he's a failure and get rid of him. Why? Maybe for dramatic purposes, I don't know. But it's like the family. It is maybe dysfunctional, but in many ways it's also successful because it stays together. It doesn't split.
Ed in Mount Washington, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark.
Hi,
how
Ed.
Are you?
I'm well, thanks.
I have every episode on tape, and
oh,
I live it religiously. I live my life according to the Gospel of Homer.
How do you do that?
I'd like to ask you a question about the direct line that Ned Flanders has to God. In one of the episodes where they're making the movies, they represent their movie. They put Todd in a basket like baby Moses and float him down the stream, and the current gets away, and Flanders, in his normal style, Flanders to God, get off your cloud and save our boy Rod.
Yes.
God sends down a lightning bolt and knocks down a tree, saves Rod, and Flanders turns to God and says, "Thanks, God," and God puts his little okay finger out and goes, "Oakley dokley, Ned." I'm Jewish, and I get a great kick out of the fun that's poked, and also the way that Jews are portrayed in The Simpsons. I think it's really, really cool. Herschel Gostofsky, who's Krusty the Clown, and also you'll see times Bart will be dressed in traditional Orthodox Jewish garb, and he'll say something like, "Oy, that guy's tough." So, you know, I think that it makes us all, I think that one of The Simpsons' great points is that it makes us all encompassing of every religion and every purpose. And you touched on that about in the church, but also just the fact that everybody's got a straight line to God and everybody's got a fair shake with God and religion in The Simpsons. And I think that's one of the most attractive parts of the show. So if you can comment on that, I'd love to hear it.
And how long have you been watching The Simpsons, Ed?
I've been watching The Simpsons since day one. I'll let you know that I'm a college graduate. I own my own business, and I think of myself as a pretty intellectually based person. But I mean, I will go home, sit for 3 hours, and watch tapes of The Simpsons over and over.
Were you a teenager when you started?
I'm 33 now.
Okay.
So
yeah.
Yeah, so I was there from the beginning, saying it's a little helper episode, and I also remember the Tracy Ullman episodes too. And it just it hit my generation right between the eyes, and it gave us insights of other people and how other people, you know, view life and religion.
So
I notice that a lot of people who are in highbrow sectors or people who are more intellectually based poo-poo The Simpsons, but we all can pick up a lesson here and there. That's for darn sure.
Thanks so much for that call.
Could you tell me what the name of that book was again?
Sure. It's The Gospel According to The Simpsons.
Okay.
By Mark Pinsky, P-I-N-S-K-Y.
I'm going to rush out and get that right now. And Mark, if you want to throw a trivia question, one quick one. I think I'm in good form.
I don't have one. Do you have one for him? Give him a trivia question.
Can you remember one of the questions that Bart put to the... To Rabbi Krestovsky?
He did. He said to Rabbi Krestovsky, if a son doesn't follow in his father's footsteps, does that make him a good son? And the rabbi's reply was, every son should have the right to do anything he wants, and if my son was a garbage collector, I would love him just as much. And then Bart turned around and said, "Then how come you don't love your son, the entertainer Krusty?" He said, "Oh, that boy, comedy is no good." And that portrays Judaism. I went into the restaurant business instead of becoming an attorney, and I'm the only non-male attorney in my family. So, and my father said I'd love my son even if he was a garbage sweeper until I went into the restaurant business.
Thanks so much.
That's a great commentary about Judaism in The Simpsons.
Thanks, Ed.
You guys have a fantastic day.
Take care.
Bye.
Matt, you were going to say something. Matt Furman.
Yeah, I would agree with Ed in terms of, and there again, I think it's a generational thing. Over the age of 35, there might be some who just see The Simpsons as a cartoon and that there's really probably nothing of merit to be found in that. Yet I know when I was in college, and I was sharing this with Mark and Corinne before we came in, my friends and I would watch the episode, tape it, and then would watch it again immediately thereafter to catch all of the subtleties. And from references to obscure film to literature to music, there was a wealth of information there. And I think it rewards a person who's the depository of trivia knowledge because you can look at that and say, I read that book. Or, you know, that's from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I watched that.
Yes, you have to watch some of the movies they talk about, refer to.
Right. So I think increasingly it'll be seen as something that has, if it's not already, has a lot of merit.
It may sound obsessive that people would watch and watch again. In my generation, it was the Fireside Theater. You could listen to it.
I remember them well.
You could listen to it seven or eight times.
Yes.
And only on the seventh listening would you get some of the references or some of the jokes. The Simpsons is a lot like that. It's highly joke intensive. It's written by, for the most part, Harvard and Harvard Lampoon and Harvard Law School graduates. It is a show that rewards intelligence. And I maintain the smarter you are, the more you pay attention, the more of the jokes you get.
Well, who is the non-believer in The Simpsons? Who is the person who says, I don't need a God and I look at my way in a different way? I mean, it seems in this world of America today where the spiritual essence of America has come alive in the last 30 years, that everyone's talking about going to church and synagogue, and that 10 to 15% of people in America who really are free thinkers who do not belong are often left out of many moral ethical folds in America. But who are they in The Simpsons?
Well, they surface in different characters. There's Homer, for example, in one episode decides he doesn't want to go to church. He said, what if we pick the wrong religion? We're just making God madder and madder every week.
Yeah.
And he speaks the thoughts that, I mean, he deals with this one true faith.
Pa
business.
Walton.
What? Right. Right. Pa Walton, who used to be a member of the Communist Party, by the way. Will Gear, back with Woody Guthrie, was in the Communist
That's
Party.
Right.
And don't think that's any accident. And then you'll hear Lisa, for example, who will be skeptical to almost to the point of non-belief. She calls people who believes that there are angels morons, for example. And she said, how can those morons believe it? And her mother says, well, morons like your mother? Because she does believe. And different people raise these issues. And even Reverend Lovejoy has his crises of faith. Even Ned Flanders, the believer, when he feels like he's Job, he asks the question, why do bad things happen to good people? Everybody else is spared in the hurricane, but his house gets flattened. And he says, what's the deal here? I give to 9 churches and I keep kosher just to be sure.
One of my favorite episodes is about Lisa becoming a Buddhist. And that is a very fascinating look at her skepticism of the church.
And monotheism.
Yes.
I want to talk about the non-monotheistic characters. Apu, I was going to bring it up anyway. I mean two things we thought about Apu. And I mean, A, as this kind of philosophical character who's a non-monotheist, as Buddhists and Hindus are, a huge portion of this world's planet. But A, he brings that kind of Hindu philosophy into the show. But B, there is a part that would bother me, that does bother me, that is the portrayal of the immigrant storekeeper who rips off the public without too much counterbalance to that.
Yeah, he's a complex character, and he gives has made life difficult for particularly adolescent children of Indian and Pakistani immigrants that I spoke with and I interviewed. He's a multifaceted character. He's a minor character, so he doesn't have a lot of things that are a lot of time on screen, but he's a vegetarian. He's a vegan. He believes in reincarnation. He has a deity, Ganesh, in his, and that's the sort of positive part about him. He's a saintly guy. He believes in nonviolence, despite the number of times he's stuck up by armed robbers at his place. But yes, he does gouge, and I think that's part of the writers. They give and they undercut.
That's right.
And they take away. So we have this with Krusty, who's in many ways really a reprobate character, but then he'll have these moments. Well, these moments of humanity. I mean, this is a tough neighborhood for narrative. I mean, there are no good and wonderful and pure characters here. But what is satirized more about Apu is the intolerance of people who don't understand him. There was one about the anti-immigrant hysteria, which was a wonderful commentary on what was then extant in America, particularly in California, with this anti-immigrant hysteria, and it brought out some wonderful points. So mostly he is misunderstood, but yes, he does have these negative characteristics. And I found when I did the chapter on Apu that American Hindus, that is Americans who have become Hindu,
right,
love the character,
but the kids
of the immigrants. It has made their life difficult because that in Middle America, that's all their fellow students know about Hinduism.
One quick comment about Apu is for myself, I have found more compassion because it's obvious to me how the community is treating him. And so instead of being one of them, I side with Apu often. Uh-huh. And I think the Simpsons do too. And he comes into their living room and watches the football games with Homer. He's always included.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. This hour we're talking about The Simpsons with Mark Pinsky, who wrote the book The Gospel According to The Simpsons, The Spiritual Life of the World's Most Animated Family. Along with him is Pastor Corin Baker from the Light Street Presbyterian Church, who led a discussion in her church about The Simpsons and some of the issues raised spiritually in that. Pastor Matthew Furman is with us from the Salem Lutheran Church, who is a major fan of The Simpsons and, as I said earlier, has an action figure of a figure of Reverend Lovejoy in his office. Kate, in your car, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks, Kate, for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I'm a big fan of The Simpsons, and I drive around with a sticker of Ralphie picking his nose on my car. And I just wanted to get everyone's reaction to the episode where Ned Flanders burns the Harry Potter books, because I thought it was kind of funny, but it's kind of serious because
yes,
it's gotten so many kids interested in reading, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Interesting. Sir Matthew Furman.
Speaking as a pastor and as a fan of Harry Potter, I was offended by that. But there again, I think it's portraying a very real part of the Christian experience in the United States. I just hope that when people watch that, same thing with another episode where Reverend Lovejoy's driving a van that looks like a bookmobile, but it's a book-burning mobile. And he's asking Lisa if there are any books that she can recommend that that the viewing audience can transcend that and say, no, they're speaking about a particular aspect of people in their understanding of faith, and that doesn't represent the whole. So that's my only reaction. I've read Harry Potter, and I loved it, so...
Any other quick reactions to that?
Well, actually, there are two references. One, the previous season that the caller was talking about it, where Ned is reading the book ostensibly to his two children, and he says, "And Harry Potter and all his friends went straight to hell for practicing witchcraft." And then he tosses, it's like a 6-second segment, and he tosses the book into the fireplace, and the kids cheer. And then in this season, they've done a kind of a Harry Potter satire. It is true. I mean, and people in the Northeast might not understand this. I live in the Sun Belt, where evangelical Christianity is very, very strong, and where more and more of America lives. And it does represent the viewpoint of some evangelical Christians. Not most, I would have to say,
right,
although it makes good TV footage to have people burning books or people saying what an evil thing, something which can be so benign and so positive about. But that's the idea. They can take these serious issues and, in a sense, disarm them.
Yes.
They mock that feeling without denigrating the belief of the person who believes that way. That's part of really the subtle genius of the show.
Chris, in your car, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark. I just want to say that I love The Simpsons, and my comment would be on one of my favorites where I might be mixing two episodes, but Reverend Lovejoy is gassing his church, about to light it on fire, and as he's about to do it, he says, "I never thought I'd have to do this again." And it was an episode where I think that everybody was following this cult leader, and it was just really interesting how they can, you know, show a really dark side of stuff and make you think. I started watching The Simpsons when I was a public defender in New York, and we would have these lunchtime meetings with the lawyers, and we would talk about this stuff like almost every day. And it would be a springboard to talk about other issues, about religion, about family, about things like that. And I just think it's such a great show on so many levels. And thanks for doing the show on the topic. I think it's a great topic.
Great. Thanks so much. Thank Aaron Henkin and all my interns. They're the ones who made this happen. Corinne, do you want to comment on that at all?
Well, I just that I would agree with him. I think that it at so many levels, it rewards us for thinking on a higher plane, and it accepts us for thinking on a lower plane.
Let me go back to phones to get some other thoughts in here. Leon, in your car, you're on the air.
Hey, Mark, how's it going?
Good, Leon.
Great episode. I wanted to say a few things. One is that I'm 39 and I love The Simpsons. You don't have to be 33 to or under to enjoy it. I've been watching it since Tracy Ullman. And I couldn't stand Tracy Ullman, but I had timed it so that by the time, I think the show The Simpsons used to come on like 15 minutes into the show or after. So I've been watching it all that time and I love it. And one of the things that really sticks in my head, one of the episodes that really sticks in my head, and I'm not a religious man and I don't know why it sticks in my head, is the one where Homer was stuck on this island and he was a missionary. Reverend Lovejoy put him on the plane to get to a... I can't remember why he put him out there. I think the town was after him for something that he did.
He had offended NPR.
He made a pledge.
That what that was?
He made a pledge.
It was a great episode. It's the one episode that I really... I mean, it was a great episode.
They sent Big Bird
after
him.
He's a missionary on this island, and, you know, he's trying to teach him about Jeebus. I mean, it was a great episode. And I guess, you know... Just to say, once again, I think it's a very funny show. I'm not intellectual, but I get a laugh every Sunday, and it's just brilliant, and it's a great topic you guys are talking about. Thanks.
Thanks, Dan. I'm going to go to Matt first. Were you about to say something about that?
Oh, no. Well, I agree with Mark that is a wonderful episode, and I think very valuable to this discussion. Homer, there again, ironic tie-in, given the nature of your show, Mark, but is sent to this island, and as he's landing and the previous missionaries are leaving, they say something to the effect of, well, we've ridiculed their culture and made them question all their beliefs. Now you can take over. And there again, it's an unfortunate but a very real experience where a particular segment, particularly a conservative segment of Christianity, would do that and continues to do that. Where I would think a more faithful response would be to act through deeds and to show love and compassion for its own merit and not for any type of ideological conversion. So it's something that the church has and the greater church has and continues to deal with, and it should, you know, call us to the carpet and say, why is this happening and how can we stop it?
Mark, go ahead.
That episode is so rich. It sticks it to public broadcasting.
Which needs it a lot of times, I would say.
For the telethons. And there's a mob that comes after Homer because he makes a pledge of $10,000 just to get his program back on, which he has no intention of paying. It sticks it to Rupert Murdoch in the same issue, in the same episode, his patron. It's a Fox show. Then he ends up on this plane just to escape the mob. And he goes to the front of it, and it's a Christian relief plane. It goes to the front of the cockpit and says, "You got to let me out. I don't even believe in Jeebus." So
Jeebus. Not only,
he doesn't even get the name right. But then he wants to get off the plane. He doesn't have the name right, but he goes to another window and he says, "Save me, Jeebus." He doesn't get the name right, but he knows where to go for the help. Then when he gets to this island, the segment on the island is so magnificent because in like 12 minutes, it presents this critique of the Western missionary experience in the third world. Like they say, the previous missionaries gave us the gift of shame. I mean, this is funny, but it's funny because it's true. Yeah. I mean, every kind of cultural contact issue that the early missionaries had, how destructive they could be of the culture. And in many ways, they've changed and improved. We have to give them credit for that.
Please.
It is such a profound episode in 22 minutes.
Thanks so much. That's interesting. Andrea in Towson, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for letting me on the show.
Sure. Thanks for calling.
I'm 42, and frankly, I feel like Matt Groening and I probably have an awful lot in common. I'm from a family of five, two parents. My father worked for a defense plant, not a nuclear plant. I am Lisa, by the way, and I have a brother who is definitely Bart, and I have a brother who's 10 years younger than me who is Maggie, you know, the unspoken one. And the family life issues, I think, are very pertinent to at least my generation, and you know, my mother who only worked part time if she worked at all, and you know, those types of things always, you know, fascinate me about his little nuclear family there, and its flaws. And one of the things I do find that The Simpsons does that is very much my generation is their focus on the big Halloween event, and I know friends who are, you know, who are very religious who especially don't particularly enjoy those shows. But, you know, Halloween was celebrated when we were children, and, you know, it was something fun to do as a community, and it certainly has changed over the years in terms of what it is or what it isn't. But he seems to not particularly care about public opinion and still put the Halloween show out pretty much every year with, you know, wanting to best himself every year. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I mean, I relate very strongly to that family and all of the issues that, you know, that the parents go through and, you know, the kid, you know, Bart misbehaving in school and, you know, Lisa being a good student and all the conflicts that raises and stuff like that.
Andrew, thanks so much for the call. Let me ask Corinne Baker to respond to this in the sense of, in your discussion groups in your church, how does what Andrew says correspond to what your parishioners say when you talk about this?
Well, one of the reasons that I did the discussions was to help all of us look at contemporary culture and faith as one, instead of separating faith on the Sabbath, whatever Sabbath you observe, and the secular world as separate. We are one, and to dissect us only makes us less than whole. And when we bring all of this into one realm, our family life and what's really realistic, I continue to harp on the point of being accepting and inclusive, and we belong as a human race. We belong to one another, and we better begin to get that.
Miriam, in your car, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I just wanted to say that I'm a conservative Baptist, and there are some things on the show that occasionally make me squirm, mm-hmm. but I sort of appreciate the show for that. And also, I was in a school class at Peabody once for musicology where we analyzed some of the music that they use, and it's amazing to me how The Simpsons is creative on so many levels. And I think that creativity is also a sign of just God's amazing abilities. And I think that it's kind of sad sometimes when mainstream Christianity finds that a target instead of celebrating the positive aspects of that.
Interesting comments. Thank you so much.
Well, I think that's true. I think particularly I tend to focus on the next-door neighbor, Ned Flanders. He does strike a chord out in the Sun Belt, out in Middle America, because he's a good person, but he's prone to some excesses. And I think people like him because they're so used – conservative Christians, evangelicals are often so offended by being the target. They're the sort of evil, sinister characters when they're there. And when they're treated fairly, they do have a sense of humor. I mean, I think that's – speaking as a Jew, it's a sign of what's called a discerning Christian or a mature Christian who can see the good and see the bad and laugh at foibles that are very common in their world. In my research, none is the target of more jokes than the Unitarians. Homer at one point says, when he's on the island, and he says, they ask him what the one true faith is. He says, if it's the Unitarians, I'll eat my hat. then there's another one where there's an ice cream social in the back of the church, and there are different bowls with toppings for the ice cream. And the one that says Unitarians is empty.
Yes.
And I think it's just that they feel that the Unitarians have – the best sense of humor and they can take that kind of stuff or what? Because although the Catholics have been the target of two or three jokes and they've raised a big hullabaloo and some of the Hindus have been concerned, the Unitarians take it all the time and they just have good humor about it, I think.
Let's get a closing comment from one of our listeners, Kelly in Lutherville. We don't have much time, but please.
Hi. I love the show.
Thank you.
Just wanted to comment. I think someone else sort of brought something up about how no one is immune to being made fun of. And I just love the satire of the show. And I had a comment. I feel like I always have to defend why I love it so much. And I was talking to someone who was about 60-ish, a friend of my father's, who said, well, the way they treat the elderly people is just awful. I said, well, isn't that sort of awful the way we treat them in our society? You know, send them off to the nursing homes and that kind of thing.
Amen. And I wish we had more time, Kelly. I'm glad you got in. I'm glad we hear your thoughts. I'm going to thank our three guests, Mark Pinsky, author of The Gospel According to the Simpsons, The Spiritual Life of the World's Most Animated Family, and Pastor Corinne Baker from the Light Street Presbyterian Church, and Pastor Matthew Furman from the Salem Lutheran Church.
Tonight on Smartline, the power plant strike, argle bargle or foo-for-aw? With us tonight are plant owner C.M. Burns, union kingpin Homer Simpson, and talk show mainstay Dr. Joyce Brothers.
I brought my own mic.
Yes. Well, Homer, organized labor has been called a lumbering dinosaur. My director is telling me not to talk to you anymore.
Woohoo!
Mr. Burns, you mentioned you wanted an opening tirade.
Yes, thank you, Kent. 15 minutes from now, I will wreak a terrible vengeance on this city. No one will be spared. No one!
A chilling vision of things to come.
That was the voice that we hear in The Simpsons all the time. And, of course, the man behind that voice is Harry Shearer. You've seen him in the movie Spinal Tap and A Mighty Wind with Chris Guest, my old high school buddies. And, of course, his Saturday Night Live, the books he's written, Man Bites Town, Not Enough Indians, a novel coming out, It's the Stupidity Stupid, and many other things he's done. And, of course, the NPR show Le Show. And Harry Shearer, welcome. Good to have you with us this hour.
Thanks very much. My pleasure.
I was watching last night some of the old clips you did from Saturday Night Live. The first thing that struck me was how some of them were still very funny, but also how you must changed in the last 25 years.
How I changed.
And you too. Humor and you have changed
in
25 years.
Oh, humor changed.
Yeah.
How would you say humor has changed?
Well, I don't know. I guess because maybe some of the pieces were about that era, so they didn't kind of fit.
Yeah.
But I guess there's a...
Because it was clean?
It was clean, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the kind of humor that's reflected in the movies that Christopher does with the whole gang is pretty much of a piece with what we were doing back then. Hopefully you learn more about your craft as you go along, so maybe you get a little better at it. But I think that it was... I think we were a minority taste back then. We're still a minority taste, you know. I think that there's always been this huge middle of comedy that's been occupied, you know, at one time or another by people who could fairly be described as panderers. And then those of us on the edge are doing other kinds of work, you know.
And, I mean, your edge also gets very political these days.
Yeah, it's been political for a while.
Yeah.
The thing is, I do reserve the right to make fun of the whole spectrum. I kind of cast a jaundiced eye at those who are satirists but only make fun of one half of the world of politics, because I think the whole world of politics is rife.
Amen.
With subject matter.
Let me switch gears here. And I mean,
yeah.
When you started out, I mean, I forgot totally about you're playing Eddie Haskell on the pilot of Leave It to Beaver.
Well, it was a forgettable moment.
But I really just totally blocked on it. And then my buddy Steve Elliott, who I was working on a project with last night, said to me as we were watching some of your old tapes. I just wondered, when you – so you've been into acting and into this world of entertainment since a young boy.
Yes.
But where did the love affair start with you and voices? You're being able to mimic and bring characters to life beyond just the kind of acting with your body, just the voice and the mind. How did that grab a hold of you? When did that start?
I guess because when I was growing up, there was still some entertainment left on radio, notably Bob and Ray, these brilliant voice comics of radio fame. They did a lot of work on The Tonight Show, too, but their most brilliant work was on radio. And Stan Freberg was doing some amazing work in the tail end of the radio era, the network radio era. And so I remember, you know, from a very early age, just sort of kind of with no vocal equipment to do so, pardon me, just trying to mimic the voices that I heard and saw, you know, on television. And I, you know, would gather friends around. My dad had a tape recorder, and we'd do sketches and shows together, and I'd sort of be the ringleader.
Mm-hmm.
So it starts pretty early. I mean, I do believe, not being a parent, but having been a kid, that, you know, unless you get really screwed up along the way, you're pretty much the person you started out as, you know, and the clues are there. Pretty early on. I mean, I was an avid newspaper reader and had this collection of like little, you know, the section headings, the mastheads from various parts of the local paper that just – it all fascinated me. The world of newspapers fascinated me. And then, you know, I end up editing my college newspaper and end up being a media gadfly later on. So this stuff all, I think, starts pretty early.
So, I mean, for you, the humor about our social and political life is something that is inside of you. It's just who you are. It's where you came from.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you see models that do it. I mean, not model ladies, but, you know.
Right.
I haven't seen a model doing much political satire lately. Although I have hopes for Heidi Klum. But, you know, Mort Saul, who was and is a brilliant political comedian, still can take a very complex political situation and boil it down to a brilliantly written joke, and has been doing that for now a ridiculous number of years.
Yeah.
And you know, that tells you, okay, there's a career to be had here. You know, you get signals that things that you are interested in or that you'd like to do, can actually lead somewhere. And then you get, it's like a go signal.
What was it? Was it Mort Saul and the Firesign Theater? Those folks, when you were a kid, did they grab you as comedians?
Mort Saul, Firesign Theater were more contemporaries.
Right. Right.
But Mort Saul, Stan Freberg, Bob and Ray, Peter Sellers, the Goon Shows, then Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. And I went to San Francisco and saw this improv group called The Committee, which was kind of spin-off but kind of an outgrowth and a further evolution of The Second City. And just brilliant, brilliant, smart, funny people on stage every night. And it looked like they were having the time of their lives. And that really was a moment when I thought, yeah, get me some of that.
Doesn't look bad to me.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they were making a lot of money, but it just looked like so much fun.
I like to talk about that process of you working with Chris. Now, I have not seen Chris Guest in maybe 40 years. We went to Stockbridge together.
Wow.
And I remember him with everybody else in the bands. We had the new Almanac Singers playing together in high school. But since, you know, in folk music and stuff. But then I'm curious about your all meeting and the beginning of your work together. And what do you think about the importance of the two movies that you made together?
Well, and we've just finished a third.
That's right here, yeah.
Yeah. Chris and I met because Michael McKeon, a third member of our little group, and I were working together on a radio, satirical radio show in Los Angeles in the early 70s. And Michael had been in bands with Chris and had said, you know, you got to meet my friend Chris when you go to New York. And Chris was working at the time on the National Lampoon Radio Hour. And when I went to New York in like 72 or 73, we hooked up and had a dinner. I just sort of made the acquaintanceship of all those guys. And then really we maintained a tenuous kind of connection until I was producing a television show with Rob Reiner, a pilot, called The TV Show, making fun of all sorts of stuff that was on television in an interesting format. And we had a first draft script, which was okay. And then I saw two pilots that Chris had done with his then partner, Tom Leopold, who was a friend of both Michael's and mine. And I saw this amazing chemistry and brilliance that Christopher and Michael and Tom had. And I said to Rob, let's hire them. And so willy-nilly, they came in to rewrite the script and to do characters and perform on the show. And that was the place where Michael and Chris and I created Spinal Tap, the band. And so we've worked together ever since then. We went together after Spinal Tap to do, in Chris's case, a year, in my case, a half year at Saturday Night Live. And then we did the Spinal Tap tour, the Break Like the Wind tour in 92, Chris and Michael and I. And Chris and I wrote some of the songs for Waiting for Guffman. And then in the meantime, we had created this other band, the Folksmen, and performed them a few times in public. And then Chris said, well, when we did a tour where we performed as the Folksmen and then came out in the second half of the show and performed a Spinal Tap. Mm-hmm. So we opened for ourselves. And then Chris started doing these movies and said, you know, we're going to do a movie about folk. And next thing we knew, I was in heels.
Do you like working in heels?
It was okay. They weren't that high. They were sensible heels.
They were sensible. I was wondering about that. I mean, mm-hmm. It seems to be a sensible side of you that,
yeah,
that would
yeah.
be important. There's always been this conversation about you and Saturday Night Live.
Uh-huh.
And whether you loved or hated your experience there.
You mean there's doubt?
There's doubt. There's no doubt, is there?
I know. I thought I erased ambiguity on that issue years ago. Hated.
So hated. What is it you hated about Saturday Night Live? Do you mind me asking?
The probably the clearest way of putting it. I mean, there were a lot of issues. I like sort of disappearing into my characters. They like the actors who play characters to basically soar above the characters. So, for example, Dan Aykroyd played Richard Nixon with a mustache, even though Nixon never had a mustache, but Dan did, and it doesn't make any difference. Or Chevy Chase never even tried to be Gerald Ford. It was just, look, now here's Gerald Ford, and Chevy walked out. And that's antithetical to my notion of how to do characters. So we had an aesthetic dispute. But there's also, you know, management style. You either believe that the way to make people do their best work is to encourage them and nurture them and make them work cooperatively and feel good about what they're doing, or you think that the way to make people do their best work is to make them fearful and competitive and paranoid.
Mm-hmm.
Got it?
Got it. Very clear.
Thank you.
Loud and clear. Harry Shearer is our guest this hour. He said, when you do The Simpsons, do you do these multiple voices like all at once? Do you jump from one to the other? Do you take a break between them? How do you do them?
We do them. We do the show basically the way an old radio broadcast was done. So it's like if you were attending a radio play. We do it in sequence, usually, one scene at a time. And if one of us, if Hank or Dan or I, who do the most voices, have to do a dialogue with ourselves, which happens often, mm-hmm. we just do it in sequence. So if Burns has a scene with Smithers, it's just done as if it were with another actor. So it's all done in a way to emphasize that we're acting as opposed to just doing lines in voices. I think that's been one of the strengths of the show, is that it's always been set up to allow us to do, you know, interact with each other and to do acting as opposed to just make noises.
That's interesting. And should you don't take a break at all. You just go right from one character to the other in the process.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'll do this, and then I'll do that.
I love that.
So to speak.
So to speak. Harry, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
It's great to have you on the air with us today.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. To hear the show again, podcast past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com.